makes her laugh.
All right, good morning, everyone. It's 9:05 a.m. on Thursday, January 30th, 2020. I'm Commissioner Brian Krosius, joined by Commissioner Randy Christman and Commissioner Julie Fedorchek. We also have staff. Do you want to, should we just quick go around the table and introduce yourself, please?
John Hsu.
Eric Miller.
Carl Carson.
Conrad Crockford.
All right, thank you. This is a work session on the rail safety program, and it's a 2019 year-end review discussion. And with that, any opening comments, Commissioner Christman?
No, I'm ready to listen.
Okay. It's all yours, Conrad.
Well, thanks. Very good. We appreciate the commission's time to be able to provide you an update on the great work that has been done by our safety inspectors out there and ensuring that the general public in North Dakota is safe as well. So with that, we've got a packet in front of us. I just want to preface, so to try to make, you know, the packet a little more condensed and to be able to kind of see pertinent information at the same time, you're going to see information on each slide that pertains to both inspectors. And we just always like to make it abundantly clear that this is not, in essence, to compare each inspector to each other. They're not in competition with each other. But it's just a better way to present the data. So you're going to see different numbers for each inspector because what they focus on and how their inspection process works is fundamentally different as well. So I just wanted to kind of preface it with that. But in light of that, I'd like to turn it over to Carl and Eric. I think they've got a really good direction on this, and so we can kind of lead through that, and then we'll conclude with some other items at the end.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Okay, so starting off, we'll go to slide two here. This is kind of just a snapshot of some numbers month by month for both the mechanical side and the track side, measuring inspection days, units or cars inspected per month, defects, violations, and a defect ratio for that month as well.
Can I ask a quick question on the inspection days? Is that based on X number of hours divided by eight, or could it also be an afternoon of inspection? And then
so an inspection day is measured by a day out inspecting. So if a report gets recorded in for an inspection, that records as a inspection day.
Okay.
So days that we're in the office doing paperwork does not record as an inspection day. But if we were out at a railroad, did some kind of inspection, went back, did a report, and filed it, that would count as a inspection day.
Okay. All right. Helpful. Thank you.
So just a couple things to point out on that. You'll notice for mechanical, we've broken it down into the number of cars that were inspected for that month. Sometimes you'll see that difference in units because a car for mechanical side for Eric is composed of many different components. And of those components, he inspects each area of it. So you'll see we tried to break it down more in simpler terms and add just the number of cars because that seems to be more apparent as far as what people are interested in knowing. It would skew it a lot if we had it in units because you'd be looking at 23,000 units. That's not to say he looked at 23,000 cars, but the different components that he has inspected on each car. And then as far as just a little more, so our year and date total, we had 139 inspection days for mechanical, 154 inspection days for the track. We issued 17 violations, and the violations come with the civil penalty, and then 9 violations for the track inspector as well.
Can that, go ahead.
I don't know, my eyes just, one thing caught my attention on the track inspections, and so it just makes for an example, I guess. Like the difference between, in defects found, between January and February, or between April and May, are so dramatic, and especially on April and May, the inspection days are about the same. So when you hit the months where you find lots of defects, is that just a bad coincidence? Or is that typically that you look at one train and you find something where there's a
I'm sorry. I didn't have the microphone on. I can explain a couple things. I guess January, there's a huge number in there, and that's part of was an ongoing investigation that kind of took all the way to Washington, D.C., so that was like a system-wide count, not just in the state of North Dakota for January. But when you see kind of a wide range, coming into the wintertime, tracks covered in snow, the rails in restriction, it's contracted because it's cold. So like in the when it's things start warming up and the sun starts coming out, a lot of that is probably in a jointed track, where then when it starts to warm up, they start to come back into compression, and then the joints that hold the rails together, you know, from going back and forth through the winter, become loose. So then I find a high number of those, you know, just walk, because they're every 39 feet. So I'll find a high number, and that really drives that number up.
Okay.
As compared to standard, you know, you're looking at a switch or something like that, and you'll find, you know, half a dozen things in there. This is, and those are 10 miles apart. These are, like say, every 39 feet. So it adds up quick.
And just to give a good example of that, for track, when they have the welded rail out there, that rail can expand or contract depending upon the temperature. 1 mile of it could expand and contract 1 foot. So you have a significant amount of play when you start dealing with longer distances and how that rail reacts with the temperature extremes.
How many expansion joints would be in that 1 mile?
That could be one continuous rail that's all welded together.
Yeah, if it's continuous welded, theoretically it could be endless.
So, but if it's expanding and contracting up to 12 inches, where's the give?
You don't want any. So it's laid at a temperature, which they try to determine as a neutral temperature, so it's put down in neither compression or tension. And it's in the best moderation for the temperature swings of the area. So if it's up here in the north, they lay it at 95 degrees. So they try to expand the rail and put it down at 95 degrees. That way it's kind of in its most neutral state for the temperature swings we have up here. But for an example, that's why the anchoring, when you see CWR violations and stuff like that, it's so critical, because you can't really predict a thermal misalignment, and it usually happens under a train and there's no signal indication or anything. So it's really crucial that that's monitored and taken care of in such a way to prevent those, because it happens, and it happens very violently. But when I talk about the joints every 39 feet, that's just the normal, I guess what we'd call like a jointed track. So there's no expansion joints in there. It's just laid at what they call the neutral temperature to keep it in a kind of. As a side note, the portion between Williston and Glasgow, Montana, last year with the cold temperatures, if you can picture, like we were saying, from A to B is fixed. Now through the winter with the rails breaking, they added over 14 feet of rail. They had to put back in. As the rail broke, they added a total of 14 more feet.
I need to go and shadow one of you. On, you know, something probably
absolutely
that would be a little bit closer, but yeah. Just
we can arrange that, and I think it'd be actually a great experience to shadow both inspectors, because you'll get an understanding of mechanical and what Eric does, sure, out there, and then what Carl does, because they are looking at different areas.
Yep, and I promise I'll be quiet in the background.
Yeah, well, so as they add
any questions.
Yeah, as they add that through the winter, then in the spring and going into the summer, that has to be taken back out to put it back at that neutral state. So it's just kind of an ongoing, revolving process. So.
Okay.
I don't know. Did that answer your question at all?
Yeah, but now this last part begs another. So 14 feet. I always thought there was more seams that were left open that they could.
Well, you're probably thinking of more of in the year the jointed rail, because when the rail is butted up against, or it might have a little gap, and then they put in the joint bars that actually connect those two chunks of rail together. So those are probably, when you hear about the clickety-clack that the train makes, that sound, that's going over all those joints. And so there's still some rail out there, and some of the expansion and contraction on the jointed rail is better, because it might have a gap to be able to expand into, or, you know, when it contracts, it might open up a little bit of a gap there.
So when they added 14 feet, I don't know how far that stretch is.
Roughly 100 plus miles.
So do they, was there like a 1 foot piece added in about every
miles,
or were they little minuscule pieces here and there, or
how? It varied, you know, anywhere from 3 to probably 8 to 10 inches. It varies when it would break. So if the rail breaks and it's under, it's cold, so then it breaks and it retracts. So then they'd come in and cut in a piece to fit that, plus that whatever it opened up. They cut either side of it, and let's say it was open up 3 inches, they cut in a piece of rail 16 foot 3 inches to fill the gap. And then they go on, and every other day or something, one breaks, and it might break 3 inches, it might break 10 inches, and it all just added up here this last winter. So they have to keep track of that and then make sure that they take that back out, because once it gets warm, you basically took, you know, a stagnant area, and then you shoved 14 more feet into there. So then as it gets warm and expands, the track has a certain resistance to movement, but with 14 feet of extra rail in there, that pressure becomes more than what the rock that's beside the track, that's meant to kind of help stabilize it, and that pressure becomes more than what that can restrain, and then the track will do like a snake, and trains don't navigate those very well.
And this is a better system than having some seams here and there that have a...
As long as it's maintained, yeah. It's a lot less maintenance. People have to review that track for them joint bars. They break, bolts come out of them. But, and a train can, if it breaks open, a train can go over a huge distance where there's the lack of rail as compared to the squiggly. But yeah, the CWR is pretty low maintenance.
CWR is with the continuous welded rail.
Sounds like a lot of maintenance. If they feel it's less, I'm sure they know more than me. Okay.
Any other questions on that kind of monthly play-by-play for 2019?
It's a lot to look at quickly. Are there any other anomalies in here that you're aware of that we should be noticing?
Probably just point of clarification too. Some of those days, months when you see may be a little less, would account for inspectors taking some time off as well when they're out there in the field. Or additionally, it could be accounted for their training that they're required to take annually, where the FRA requires them to attend what they call a recurrency training for their particular discipline. So each year they have to attend that training, and that's a week-long training. So.
No.
I can
Okay. I can
do it.
Okay, go ahead.
So slide 3 here is kind of a rolling 12-month diagram of out of 100% of our defects that we take, these are the percentages each month that they fall into. So first slide on the left here is the mechanical. So I inspect freight car safety standards, the reflectorization, the safety appliances, brake systems, and then freight car securements, which would be your handbrakes for each train or every cut of car sitting somewhere. And then it kind of depicts what percentages every month of those defects that I've had. Kind of fluctuates up and down here and there, but really no significant anomalies in this depiction.
Do you want to kind of explain each category and what might be a component you find in each one?
So the blue one here, freight car safety standards, that would consume brakes, side bearings, journals, wheel bearings, axles, things of that nature. Your reflectorization is the yellow reflector tape that they put on each car, every locomotive. What that's for is for safety as they're going through road grade crossings that at night they light up as your headlights are on them. So they would see trains because they had a significant amount of accidents as people were hitting trains at crossings for that reason. Safety appliances, like this category includes ladders, handholds, handbrakes, things of that nature, things people would touch, crawl up on, platforms, things like that.
For the rail employees.
For the employees.
Could be rail employee, also could be an industry employee folks for cars also. That might be delivered to a grain elevator. They may climb up on those ladders, side ladders as well, to access the cars. Right.
brake systems, obviously that's pretty self-explanatory, the air brake system in full, which does include the tests that they do on them at each location, the extended haul, stuff like that, all that kind of falls into that bucket. And then again, the freight car securement is the use of the handbrakes being tied down when they're not being attended to by rail employees.
Right. So with handbrakes, each car is equipped with a mechanical brake that is set by an individual. The car's primary braking system is an air brake system that's fed via compressed air from the locomotive, is where the air compressors are at. So when they're in a train, that's how that system functions. But when the car is left standing by itself, or a cut of cars is left not connected to an air source, that air eventually will bleed off, just like an air compressor at your house or your shop. You're going to lose the air pressure on that. And when that air bleeds off, the brakes actually will release, because the system takes air pressure to apply the brakes, is how this system is designed. So there's requirements when an employee is going to need to go and set those handbrakes to ensure that even if the air breaks off, that that car or cut of cars is not going to roll away and into where somebody else is working or into an active track and have a sideswipe situation with another train.
That's something to that effect happened at Lac-Mégantic in Quebec, I believe, when it rolled backward, 20 miles?
That's exactly what happened there. The quick scenario for that is that the operating railroad there sided the train. They were out of operating hours. They left the locomotives running, because as long as the locomotives are running, it's supplying that compressed air to the cars and to the train itself. When there was a fire that erupted on a locomotive, so a mechanical employee for the railroad came out, shut the locomotives down, the fire department arrived, they put the fire out. But now with those locomotives not running and there were insufficient handbrakes set on the train, then once that air bled off, that train was free to roll. And that's exactly what happened.
47 people were killed in that. It hit the bend in town. It was just going too fast.
Just, everything came together on that recipe for disaster.
I'll let you go through your ears.
Okay, well, for the track, it's very much the same. Eric, I guess, mentioned no real anomalies, and I guess you'll probably see there is an anomaly in mine, but like I spoke to, that was part of an ongoing investigation, which identified a huge number of defects, but that was kind of across multi-states. I just happened to be the one that ended up taking the defects for it, so that's why there's a huge count. But as you go through mine, like we talked a little bit, there's some seasonal aspects. If the track's covered in snow, kind of the switches are generally always occurring type thing, looking at kind of like, much like Eric with the cars, that's kind of an always thing. But you'll get into vegetation as you get into summer and then the fall and drainage and things of that nature. So there is a little bit of seasonal changes throughout mine that could be noticed.
I'm going to jump ahead just a second here.
Sure.
We have 35 minutes before our next work session on a different topic, and this is really good information. I don't know if we'll get through it in the next 35 minutes because we're on slide 4, and that's fine. But I'm wondering if we're going to want to look at breaking this into a second part potentially. This is more detailed.
Yes, I was kind of thinking the same thing.
Absolutely. Depending upon the commission schedule, we can certainly make a kind of a part two to this as well.
Yeah. So keep going, but don't feel rushed, because I just don't think we're going to.
Yeah, some of this coming up is kind of redundant, as kind of more the first page is kind of a different look at it.
We may make it, but if not, we can certainly schedule an initial session.
Just be thorough, because this is really good.
Sure. So on slide 4 here, we have a goal for us to reach 130 inspection days per year. And this kind of just depicts where we are trending throughout our biennial year with reaching that goal. You can see both Carl and I are above the trending limit of reaching that 130.
And just a point of to provide you some clarification on this, the agreement that the commission has with the FRA for utilizing this inspection program has a requirement of 60 inspection days per year. So that's what they said as their minimum. When we established the program, we looked at it and said, you know what, we understand that's their minimum, but we want to expand upon that, and we want to be more aggressive in our process. And so that's where we set our goal at 130 days.
So we can deviate from this if we want to.
Absolutely, yep. Provided we're meeting that minimum threshold of 60 inspection days per year, then we can certainly, you know, adjust ours. This is just one that we established for ourselves.
Okay.
Morning, everybody. Sorry I'm late.
Morning.
I'm planning on my part.
No problem.
I do hear from you guys regularly. You guys
absolutely.
Okay.
All right, so.
What?
You almost hit me right in the dance.
This morning?
Yeah.
Did I? Yeah, that's when I realized, God, today's chili cook-off.
That's when I realized it, too. That's why I was leaving.
Oh, man. Anyway.
Okay, slide 5.
Slide 5.
Did you go over the inspection days why?
We just finished it. We said okay. Talked about the FRA minimum and where we've set ours at. And
that's a really important point for legislators. Okay. And they've always hit it, exceeded it.
So. Absolutely.
So slide 5 kind of compares how we stand as inspectors for the state of North Dakota versus the average of federal inspectors within Region 8, which includes North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington.
And Alaska.
I had to forget about them.
Which is your green and blue bar. The red and purple is the whole nationwide. So it takes an average of all the inspectors on the federal side and then compares them to us. So you can see here our numbers, you know, mechanical, I think I was at 139 versus where everybody else's averages were at.
Tell me the states again, would you?
It would be North Dakota, South Dakota, part of Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, Alaska. And that's our Region 8 for federal inspectors.
Your inspection days aren't in their averages, correct?
Ours are our raw numbers. The other ones are averages from the other areas.
Okay. So they don't take your inspection days, though, and weave it into there.
Sure. Yeah,
they do.
You would be included.
I would be included in that average.
Right.
Yes.
The FRA does include their inspection days in those total numbers.
You pull their overall average up, then.
Absolutely.
You exceed. Okay.
So, any questions on this one? Yep. For slide 6, again, is inspection days, but now instead of comparing us against the averages of the federal inspectors, now we're comparing ours to other state inspectors for the other areas. And again, the green and blue is Region 8, and the orange is national.
What do you attribute the anemic performance on a national basis for TRAC? I mean, it's not even close to the days you're putting in.
Some of this might be the fact that, depending upon the state employs different disciplines. Some states have all the FRA inspection disciplines, if there are 6 of them, and some states do not. Maybe they just have, for example, Montana only has mechanical inspectors. So there may be maybe some of it's construed that way. Additionally, talking with the other state inspectors, we have, as far as my experience, and the other state program managers, we have the highest goal that I've seen out there as far as what we expect out of our inspectors. And some other states, the inspector, while they are certified FRA inspector and work under this program, they may have other additional duties that they work on as well.
Any other questions regarding the inspection days? Slide 7 is units inspected. And this is where Conrad had mentioned before, my units are going to look considerably skewed because every car can consist of 5 or 6 units. So you'll see my number there, 35,000, is the high end of that graph, where Carl's is 4,500.
You got to pick up the pace, Carl.
Once again, not comparing each other. Yeah.
Right.
Apples and oranges over here.
Be sure to leave plenty of time for the examples. We've got another meeting at 10, so some of the examples are the most compelling.
So in this, and again, just to reiterate, this is against the federal FRA inspectors. On to slide 8 is the units comparison for other state inspectors. Slide 9, defects versus the federal inspectors. And I would definitely say I think some of the reason our defects are higher is just simply because we're out there more.
Right.
And we just we look at a lot more.
And this is this an average per inspector, then, or how would these be calculated?
These
defects.
Wow. Again, the yellow is our raw numbers. The other columns are averages for your Region 8 inspectors and then nationally.
Okay.
Which does include their numbers as well.
But ours looks higher because we're not averaging. I mean, part of it is we're not averaging with anybody. We've got one.
Correct. These are raw numbers for us.
So it's, you know, that's part of the reason why ours would be so high. There might be single inspectors out there in these other regions or the nationally that have numbers as high as you guys. It's just that they're averaged, so they won't show up.
But if a state, and I'll just use 1,000 for that, for an, kind of an average, if a state has two inspectors, say for mechanical, then would they be figured in here as 1,000 each,
or
could that potentially be that state has 1,000 and they have multiple inspectors?
This would be per inspector.
Per inspector. Okay.
So. Slide 10 again. Here's your defects versus other state inspectors. And then slide 11 is the violations taken versus other federal inspectors. I do think the average for mechanical for 2019 is higher than it probably had been in previous years that I can recall.
So what explains the difference when, in terms of number of defects, does that go back to how it's calculated or how it's measured at, you know, what you're doing versus, I'm just looking at, you're finding more defects than Region 8 or national, but they're issuing as many, if not more, violations.
And I didn't look into the details of what they're specifically having. I do know, just for instance, in December, I know the FRA inspector took a violation. Just in December, had 61 violations. It was one car that traveled for 61 days without having a repair made that could have caused a derailment. And the inspector took a violation per day that it was on the road after notification.
You would have done one?
No, I probably also would have done the 61 days, but that does skew the numbers considerably when you look, when you put it as a lump that he took 61 in December alone, and I had, I don't know, one or two, I think, in December.
It's pretty important because of those sorts of things, and there's sometimes these, like, really intense focus inspections that they get, you know, a bunch of inspectors out there and do a whole bunch of inspections, and that sort of skews the numbers. So it's pretty important to look at this stuff over time,
right,
trending, and these guys are really good about that. Like, so you're consistent, and we're extremely consistent in our patterns. And I think this defect versus violations also goes back to some of the philosophy of trying to work with the railroads, identify the problems, let them know you got to fix these before they become violations, not going out there, you know, on the front end doing violations and trying to play gotcha. And I think that, you know, that's reflected in the numbers.
In years past, I know for myself, I've had a significantly higher number of violations. In the last year and recently, I've not found as many significant issues that warranted a violation. So that's drove my number down.
Which is good.
Be a real shame if they were keeping their stuff up better and able to find anything, huh?
Right. But that's also important for us to note, because the fact that we're out there, we're finding defects, that shows that there's still problems. It also shows, if you're not finding the violations, that hopefully the railroads are doing the fixes.
Yeah.
That's what we want. But if it would be wrong for the legislature to look at and say, well, there's not many violations, you know, in any given year, so that means that we don't need the inspection program anymore because everything's fine. Because the minute you back off on it, then you're going to have to see slippage in the other side when there's not a lot of compliance action. And these guys have worked hard to have relationships with the folks that they're inspecting and teaching them. So,
slide 11, I think, is where we're at. And that's just 12 violations compared to other state programs, state inspectors. And that pretty much wraps up the numbers data side of it. Slide 13 is kind of a snapshot with some pictures here of a violation I did take. This was up in Tioga back in October at the Hess facility. And you can see here, the picture didn't turn out as great as I wanted it to. But that shell spot there in that wheel, you can see that the tread is starting to come apart. And it's in non-compliance for that. What drove the violation in this is that the BNSF mechanical team had already been out there, already inspected this train. They were loading it with crude oil. It was headed out of town within the hour. So had I not caught this, this would have been running up and down the road, causing rail damage, wheel damage. There could have been some potential issues that this could have drove. So we went ahead and issued the violation, and quite honestly, there was no complaints. They talked to the mobile crew that was out there. Yep, we missed it. That's, you know, we get that. We see it. That's definitely a bad thing. Took it with a grain of salt and move on.
So when they're out there looking at for that, and if that is, just say that part is on the bottom of the track, do they move the train to turn it a half?
No,
give a half turn and then go back?
They inspect it as it sits, and that can be one way that some of this does get missed.
Right.
But I do know from working with those guys up there, they take a lot of pride in what they do,
and
it doesn't happen very often. And the probability of it actually, you know, one thing like this being right on the rail or behind the brake shoe while you're sitting there, it's pretty low, but it does happen.
Mm-hmm. So at this transload facility, what happened there? I'm assuming they disconnect, pull that car out of the line, get the rest of the train moving when it was supposed to.
Yep, they'll set that car out specifically. They may or may not put another car in so they have a full unit train. This depends on their billing, how they choose to do that, and then they make sure that train goes out on time
and
still.
Do they send someone out and replace this wheel?
Yep. So they'll
at
send
that site,
it.
Or they
at that spot site, somewhere and they'll actually do it right there. They've got an area where they'll set all the bad order wheel cars, and they'll just change the wheels right there.
Okay.
Yep. Slide 14. Another indication, so this was a train that was in Rogers at the elevator, 100, 110 cars. I looked it up at 100 of them because they were the ones not being loaded at the time. Walked through it, found a significant number of defects, including these two side bearings that were broken. Didn't take a huge exception. Side bearings fatigue, they break, things happen. The problem I had with this is it had a mechanical inspection in St. Paul days prior where it traveled directly to Rogers and sat there. In 100 cars that I looked at, I took 59 defects.
Jeez.
That tells me that their mechanical group's not doing an effective inspection.
Right. And you could tell that the brake was older. Fresh.
Oh, it wasn't fresh. It was right. Old. They flat out missed it.
Yeah.
But furthermore than them just missing something, 59 defects in a train is not okay. That's them not putting forth a good effort into that inspection.
Right.
So we had some conversations with them and then followed up with the violations for both of these side bearings.
And them being BNSF's
or CP.
CP's internal inspectors.
Yes. Yeah. And just to give you a little bit more of a perspective, where a side bearing is at, so you've got your wheels that sit on the rail. There's two axles typically per truck. And the truck is what the axles ride on. And then the side bearings are sitting on either side of the truck. And then what that does is help stabilize the car as it goes down the track and through curves. So if those weren't there, then the car could potentially lean further in curves and have some issues navigating those curves. So that's what a side bearing does on a car.
Any questions regarding the violation pictures?
Where's the defect on that?
So the cage of that side bearing is supposed to wrap around the internal components of that and mm-hmm. hold everything in. You can see on the right-hand side that cage is broken away. It's starting to deteriorate.
Okay.
Again, the picture didn't come through quite as well as I'd hoped, but yeah, it's definitely coming apart and breaking.
Okay, this is just one of the violations of track that I took in 2019. As you can see in the pictures on page 16, what happened is there's culverts that run underneath the track to transfer water from side to side through, you know, from the runoff through weather. The culverts degraded to a point where they separated inside or broke, and the ballast fell down into the track and washed away. The reason why I took a violation on this spot is as I was going, we found 13 locations within 10 miles where culverts had been damaged. And I guess getting back to the whole premise on our inspections is we're not there to find the defects for them. We're there to make sure that they're finding them and identifying them. And much like Eric, 59 defects in one train set's not acceptable. And having 13 of these culverts damaged within 10 miles was not acceptable either. It's about making the point that these guys need to be watching and looking for these defects on their own and identifying them, not us. So that is the reason why I took not only the safety issue with, like I talked about, the ballast being in position to hold the track. If there's no supporting subgrade, you know, the car can lean and obviously lead to a derailment. So that's why I took the violations on these. And this is they made an argument about there was a high level of rain, which, yeah, I get it. There is, but that's why the culverts are there to do their job to pass the water through. And if they're broken, then they're not going to do it.
Are you going to talk just kind of touch base on those pictures?
Yeah. Again, you're just looking at a longitudinal view of the track. And I made note of this picture because you can see the difference as you look at the picture. And that's what eludes you to the problem. As you can see, there's ballast in between the ties. Up into a point where there's not, and then a hole right beside the track. And it was about 3 feet deep, about 4 feet wide. So again, it's not something that was not readily visible as you were going down the track.
Are these like corrugated metal culverts?
There's concrete sections. Sectional ones. There's solid steel pipe. There's corrugated metal. There's wooden box culverts.
These are situations where either they rust out or the concrete ones come apart.
The concrete's come apart, yep. Yep, they break or they separate, and then the ballast falls through, and they just continue to deteriorate. And like I say, if there's no supporting structure underneath the ties and the rail, then it causes the cars to lean or sway, which will lead to a derailment, or the rails to break if there's no supporting structure under them.
Okay. You might want to go up there with your skid steer. I've seen some of your work, and you do good water weight.
I could definitely do that.
You need some good skid steer, man. Yeah.
It's one of my hidden talents.
So on the next slide here, going forward in kind of what we're looking to be able to capitalize upon some of the training that is offered out there and for our inspectors to provide additional assistance and inspection overviews for the different disciplines that the FRA has offered. The FRA is now offering opportunities for inspectors to become certified in two disciplines. So right now, Carl is certified in the track discipline, and Eric is certified in the mechanical, or as the formal title is, motive power and equipment. He's allowed to look at cars and locomotives under his discipline. The other four disciplines that are offered is hazardous material, operating practices, and what that deals with is the actual train control that the conductor and the engineer are doing. Signal and train control, so that's the actual fixed signals you'll see on the side of the tracks, and how those interwork with each other. And then the final one is a grade crossing, so actually going out and inspecting public grade crossings for safety issues or areas that are not being kept up. So that's the disciplines that are offered there. And on the next slide, what we'd like to do for the program, and speaking with both inspectors, and it seems like it's a perfect fit for our program and the two inspectors we have, is having each inspector carry an additional certification. What we're proposing is for Eric to carry the hazmat certification, and what that is he is already in the rail yards and at the crude terminals that have hazardous materials doing inspections upon the cars. Carrying the hazmat certification would allow him to actually do the inspection on the closures of the cars to make sure, were they closed and sealed properly, they're not leaking, are there issues with the loading operations. He can look at the records that a loading facility would have out there for when they loaded the cars, how they loaded them, and it opens up that door. So we wouldn't see that as any additional burden for him as an inspector because he's already at the facility itself. It would just be an additional component to his inspection process. And what we're proposing for Carl as a track inspector is to carry the grade crossing certification. Given that that is a huge safety issue, it seems every couple of weeks you see an issue or a motorist and train collision out there. And so carrying that would allow him to go and inspect these grade crossings. He's already at the grade crossings when he conducts his inspection. That's how he accesses the track, to either walk it or ride down the track with a railroad employee. So it's a good target of opportunity for him to be able to conduct an inspection at the grade crossing areas as well. It would require some additional training for each inspector. Training is typically funded by the FRA, but as far as the expense of that, it wouldn't be too much in the case for Carl. He's already, the grade crossing specialist that does the training is located right here in Bismarck. Her name is Tammy Wagner. I've talked to her about the possibility of this, and she's very excited about it, and all for Carl being able to carry that certification. And then Eric would have to travel to the hazmat fundamentals class to get that training, which we could put forward in our grant funding with the FRA for the next round to get some funding for him to be able to carry that additional certification. But just wanted to bring that topic to the commission to see what your thoughts on that would be, to be able to provide some additional oversight and inspection areas that and they can provide some additional safety oversight as well.
So these guys presented this to me probably in December.
We spoke about it.
And we talked through it. I think it's a good idea because they're already out there and they can incorporate these things into their other work. And also because when we first started this program, hazmat was an area that a lot of people talked about and were questioning why, with the type of traffic we have and the type of products, why we aren't focusing on hazmat. And the answer was, well, yeah, it's important, but if you look at the statistics, it's not as important as these other two things. And we feel that, you know, with the limited dollars, we don't have enough for four inspectors. We'll just focus on what we can. And then the grade crossing was also, when you look at the numbers of where the deaths occur on grade crossings.
Absolutely.
And so we can be out there taking a look at those and helping with the inspection of those grade crossings. I think it just addresses the area that contributes to kind of some of the most dramatic things we see on the railroads involving pedestrians and drivers, et cetera. So that's why I think it's a good idea. You run the risk of spreading them a little thinner, but they feel like it's not going to do that, and it's kind of a natural part of what they're doing, or a natural extension of what they're doing. So,
I don't know how soon you're thinking of making a decision, and within our time constraints here, but I'll just throw this out without thinking through it. So maybe I'll wish I hadn't. Yeah, deaths occur at grade crossings, but aren't a lot of them because of signal and train controls? So I guess I would want better explanation of what exactly the difference. If I were just imagining this, I would think that signal and train controls would be a part of an issue within grade crossing. So I guess just that delineation would be my biggest question.
Isn't this more about making sure that inspecting the integrity of the grade crossing versus how many close calls were at that particular crossing? Because the railroads BNSF, I know for sure, they record every close call. They have to.
Right.
So, you know, they hit the horn when they're approaching a crossing. If a vehicle, you know, isn't paying attention and they hop over the crossing right in front, that's a close call. And they have a threshold, and I don't know if it's two or if it's three, but it's not that many close calls at a grade crossing. And then they have to put signals in.
That's correct. And this is, you know, just like the railroads have the responsibility to maintain their cars in the fleet, they have a responsibility to maintain the track, they have a responsibility to maintain the grade crossing to a certain standard, and that includes visibility issues, vegetation issues that may be out there. And then, Commissioner Crisman, what might help is, as far as the signal and train control, that deals with how that system actually is going to function electronically, and ensuring that the signals, you know, provide the right signalization. So when it comes to not just at grade crossings, and yeah, and that particular discipline doesn't deal with should this crossing have lights and gates or not have lights and gates. That's a separate topic. But how do those systems interact when a train approaches a grade crossing? Do the arms lower at the appropriate time? Do the lights come on? Does the bell clang? That's a signal portion of it. And similar, if you have a traffic light and you know a street that comes in, you've got a traffic light and you've got a grade crossing. When the train approaches a grade crossing, does that crossing system interact with the traffic signals to basically put a red light there when the, you know, to stop traffic when the train is approaching and occupying the crossing, and then does it allow traffic to commence once the crossing is clear? So that's more of a signal and train control item right there.
It's just always been a pet peeve of mine from personal experiences where I have lived most of my life to see people just almost trained to go through the lights, because sometimes they just sit there for hours and hours, and I mean, you'd be a fool to just while away your whole day when there's obviously no train coming, and the lights sometimes go most of the day.
Right, and that's
that's changed. You know, I have been up there that much the last 7 years.
And that's a component of, you know, that grade crossing specialty as far as, you know, what expecting the appliances that are already fixed at that crossing and how they're going to, you know, how the railroad's maintaining them. So that would be separate. I just kind of wanted to provide that example. That's separate from kind of the signal and train control, which deals with how they dispatch locomotives and use those signals on the track as well.
Okay.
Carl, do you have any further clarification in terms of the impact that inspections on grade crossings might address the safety of their use versus focusing on signal and train control?
I'm sorry. Well, like Eric Conrad said, it's something that I'm already there, you know, and approaching the crossing and taking a look at it, and it is a significant safety factor. We do some. This would kind of give us more of an authoritative role, I guess, and to take action. Like you say, the crossing gates being down, and yes, it's a signal type instance, but if we find it, we can act on it more so than handing it off to, say, the federal guys. We can take more of an active role in it of ourselves. And even in the passive warning systems, we can take more of an active role if we have the certification and the ability to file the reports and do the legwork versus handing it off to the other agency to kind of let them do it at their discretion.
And part of that process is inspecting the signage, inspecting, you know, when you approach a railroad crossing, you always have the circular sign that has the railroad crossing symbol on it. That's part of that process. Is the signage appropriate for the motorists, for the traveling public as they approach a crossing, that it's properly notifying them? Additionally, this can loop us into the process that is utilized, that DOT uses when they work with the railroads to have crossings upgraded from a passive crossing, which is just your crossbucks or your stop sign, to actually lights or lights and gates, and to be involved in some of that process as a safety aspect, because right now the FRA inspectors are involved in that too, and so this would loop us into that crossing modernization process as well.
Well, and one of the big things would also put us in some of the conversations of when they go to silent crossings in towns throughout.
Absolutely. So if there's any, you know, if Bismarck has three crossings that are a quiet zone, you're not hearing the train horns at those crossings in downtown anymore. So as maybe more communities want to view looking at that process, it's a huge undertaking, that an inspection process involved with doing that. And then the last slide here, just providing you an update on our current grant program.
Before we leave that, do you want to think more about pursuing these other certifications? Are you okay with them going ahead?
What's the process for us to do that? Just
well, that doesn't cost.
Casually decide. Do we bring? Yeah. Is it in a commission motion? Because we have to determine whether to pursue the right training and. I don't know what
action. Well, that's all laid out by the FRA, and we didn't lay out specific action at the commission level when we decided which disciplines or any of that. It was all part of the budget, so I don't think we...
Our process for that would be for myself to reach out to the FRA and make the request that we want our inspectors to obtain the dual certification in these categories. We need to be... Let's start that process. And then, you know, if we have to get some forms and paperwork filled out ahead of time, we can do that as well.
Well, right now, I think you've explained it pretty well. If I think of any other concerns, I'll let you know within the day or two.
Certainly.
We'll just have to make sure we're adequately prepared, because when there's a wheel bearing that's cracked or defective, the public doesn't see it. When there's an issue with the public interacting or with a rail crossing, or maybe we're probably getting a lot of those calls anyway, but all of a sudden, if we're a part of the, you know, you're a part of that authority, or the commission is, having some authority with that, there might be a few more calls coming in.
Could you put together just a budget, though, so we know what the numbers are, and you've kind of looked through all the potential areas where the expenses could go up and how we'll cover them?
I think that's important. And then also the training time, how much is that going to pull away from the inspections we're doing?
Okay.
Sure, certainly.
I like that you guys are eager to do it and you want to learn more and be more involved, so I appreciate that.
Absolutely. And just the last couple minutes, just to give you a brief update, the FRA transitioned to a grant-based funding for the state participation program. It used to be a direct reimbursement. The inspectors would travel to training. They'd file a federal voucher for reimbursement for those expenses. Same thing when I would go to an annual meeting. They've now been to a grant-based funding opportunity. The first time we're involved in it now was just this last September, when the grants were awarded. We were awarded $10,465, which includes $8,465 for training and travel, and then $2,000 allotted for two laptop computers. So the computers they currently have were issued to them by the federal government. We're going to be transitioning them over, and those computers we purchase are going to be state computers, and that we own and control those computers. And that's just the difference in how FRA is planning on funding the program. And I just kind of gave you a quick snapshot on things right there as well. So, and we can certainly make an additional request for funding for the next grant cycle, which we'll have to make. Usually those applications are due in May, and then we can make the request for funding for training dollars for the dual certification process as well at that time.
So no commission action on outside of just through the budget process of the budget, et cetera.
We should review that.
We'll have them come back.
Yep, I'll certainly come back with the information.
Are there any, like with the AML program, there are disclosure conflict of interest statements we fill out?
No, for us?
There aren't any on the rail side, right?
We have an annual agreement through the FRA that we do submit to our attorney to review on an annual basis for signature for participation in the program. And then as far as the grant, there was just a few conflict of interest things when we just submitted for and applied for the grant, okay. But nothing on a large scale.
Okay, well, this probably isn't applicable, but my brother-in-law is an engineer for BNSF. So I just want to make sure that that doesn't create any type of a conflict of interest in terms of any action we take. So sounds like that's not a thing that we have to look at, but you know, just full disclosure in the event. Well, yeah, we do have to know about those things if we... Sounds like we're fine. I just didn't want to surprise or have anyone surprised.
No, and I don't think that your brother-in-law working for BNSF and you being a commissioner is a conflict of interest.
Just doesn't want to give the appearance of, you know, we're lenient because of that connection. But okay, better safe than sorry.
Right.
I just wanted to bring it up.
Thanks, you guys.
Nice work.
Not bad on time management.
I think we
could have prepared at least another minute of it.
We got started 5 minutes late, though. If we started at 9 instead of...